art in its lesser sense also is not utilitarian. It's not there for the good that it can do us. It doesn't do anything but transform utterly. I mean, I just love that. It does nothing except transform everything. You know, that's just a great line. Its value is that it is. And to me, that's at the heart of a Christian conception of poetry, and really at the heart of what I think this project is about. In one sense or another, every poem in this book, you know, is what, you know, is useless with the uselessness of art that's meant for nothing but the beautiful, even though sometimes it's not pretty, that does nothing but transform utterly.
Micah Maddox is poetry editor at First Things and professor of English at Regent University in Virginia. He's published a book of essays on poetry titled The Soul is a Stranger in This World, and his criticism has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and The National Review. Sally Thomas is the author of the poetry collection Motherland, as well as a novel, Works of Mercy. She's published poetry, fiction, reviews, and essays in such venues as First Things, Plow Quarterly, and The New Yorker. She serves as associate poetry editor for The New York Sun. Together, Maddox and Thomas are editors of a new anthology we discuss today, Christian Poetry Since 1940. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Micah Maddox, Sally Thomas, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate this.
Thank you for having us.
So we're talking here about this anthology just recently published. I was actually on the waiting list to get it, so I got it right when it came out. This is a recently published anthology, Christian Poetry in America Since 1940. I'm interested just in asking some general questions at the outset about how the anthology was conceived, why you two were its editors, and why Christian Poetry in America Since 1940 and not 1930 and 1950, 1967, or whatever.
Right. I'll jump in on that, and then I can turn to Sal if she has anything to add. But it came into to being when Paraclete reached out to me through a mutual friend and asked me if I would consider putting an anthology together on Christian poetry, contemporary Christian poetry. And I took some time to think about it. One, would this anthology be useful? Is it needed? And after doing some bookworming and so forth, I decided that I think this actually would be very needed and hopefully very, very useful. And so, and then I reached out to Sally, whom I've read for years and admired. She's obviously a very gifted poet, but also a gifted prose stylist. And I knew we wanted someone who could help with the introductions and has a great ear and eye for poetry. And so I reached out, and she very graciously agreed, even though she knew that this meant that her poetry could not be included. You know, I would have loved, that's my only regret is not being able to include her work. But and so she graciously agreed to join me in helping with the project. And so it took us about, I guess, a year and a half or so, I can't remember now, but to put it all together and so forth. Why 1940? Well, I think the main answer to that is we wanted poets who were, for the most part, still living and still working. And so the 1940 comes from the birth date. Paul Mariani was born in the year of 1940. So it's somewhat arbitrary in the sense that we could have included poets who were born a few years earlier. And but at some point, you just have to draw a line it gives you a selection that's manageable for a book of this size. And so the 1940 comes from wanting to include largely poets that were still living, contemporary poets and working. And Sally very wisely wanted to avoid using the phrase contemporary Christian in the title because of the associations with other sort of contemporary Christian artwork. So,
great. Sally, what would you add to what Micah said?
Yeah, I mean, you know, another thing that occurred to me about that sort of 1940 cutoff, which, you know, as Micah noted, in some ways is kind of arbitrary, but it gives us really kind of an interesting generational theme. And obviously we're representing several generations of poets and waves. But I mean, it's interesting to start at a point in what we call contemporary poetry, which, you know, is that really elastic term that sort of almost goes back so far that it bumps up against modernism and, but it's still these young poets writing today. And, you know, it's interesting to me that we've begun with a generation of American poets who are younger than the poets who came of age right at the mid-century in the 50s and 60s and are sort of hammering out, breaks from tradition in terms of their style and things like that. In one sense, with the generation of poets that we began with, they've got a landscape that is sort of wide open in terms of, you know, like it's not that revolutionary to be writing in free verse anymore. It's, I don't know. There are always schools of thought that are going to say it's reactionary to be writing in form. That's sort of a dicier claim. But, in one sense, it seems like a wider open space in contemporary poetry, just in terms of the poetic tradition in America and conventions. And that's really interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me pick up on that, as a matter of fact, if I may ask you something here. The selections in the poetry in the anthology I thought were great, and there are 35 different poets, I think, if I counted correctly. If not 35, then 34 or 36, somewhere right around there. So you obviously know poetry, you know poets, and you know how to write about them, because there's great criticism in the introductions even to the various authors. That said, I'm curious, as you thought about this volume in relation to the larger landscape of poetry, were there surprises for you as you worked on this project, right? Did you come to understand Christian poetry or simply poetry, contemporary poetry, differently by working on the volume?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, when I started working on it, I knew that there were a lot of great poets that were usually not lauded in our flagship publications. And I would go back and do copy edits and read these poems again. I was just struck at really how many excellent poets we have working and publishing and winning prizes. So that's one thing that I think just sort of struck me. And then and writing in many sort of different styles and on different sensibilities. It's really surprising. It kind of reminds me of, England in the Larkin era. You certainly have Larkin working, but this is the post-Auden, post-Eliot era largely. And it's just, we have a bunch of really gifted poets working. There's not one or two figures that, you can stick a flag next to, but you have all these individuals very accomplished. And so that struck me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, one of the delights of collaboration is that, there were a body of poets that we both knew, whose work we both knew, but I think we both had our favorites, right?
Sure. And,
and in some cases, certainly for my part, I mean, some of Micah's favorites were poets whose names I'd heard, but I hadn't really engaged with their work at all. And so just to read poets I hadn't really read before was it was wonderful to have to do that.
One of the difficult things I think for us was excluding, there was just their names that would come up again and again, and should we include this person or that person? And we wanted the volume to be somewhat selective. You'll see in the volume that some poets have a larger selection of verse that we've included, five or seven poems, and those are the major figures, but we wanted to include maybe figures that minor is not the right word, but perhaps not as well known and not as prestigious or length of publication, include them as well. But that was very difficult for us. And we went back and forth quite a bit on on that topic in particular.
It could only have been brutal to make those selections. I mean, that's the nature of writing an anthology or editing anything. That's just, you have to make these hard choices. I've talked with people on this podcast before who are wonderful poets who are not in the volume. But if there were a volume two issued in sort of 15 years, I think without question will be in this volume. In fact, that goes to the point, right? So you include, again, there are 35 poets here. There might have been, let's agree, 50, 60, or more that you might have done if the volume could have been twice its length.
Right.
And you mentioned that there's been an introduction, that there's been a revival of Christian poetry in America. Why is that?
That's a great question. It's one that I still don't know the answer to entirely. I've tried to figure it out. But I think there's a couple of things that have contributed to it. One, a lot of the experimental poetry in the United States in the 70s and 80s, the move away from narrative poetry, away from representation, towards kind of a pure formlessness or attempt of a pure formlessness, made a space for poets who tend to write, and Christian poets do tend to write in more sort of traditional form and through narrative. And so I think there was a sense in which we have individuals who love poetry, but who have a hard time finding poets that they love to read and admire, and they end up writing themselves and turn out to be very, very gifted. I think that's part of it. I also think that the United States is unique in the Western world today for the number of Christian institutions that we, of higher education that we have, that end up supporting poets to be able to write. So I think that also contributed to the support and flourishing of the art.
Great. Let me ask you about a distinction, all right, that you make. It's not yours, but you draw on it. It's a distinction made by C.S. Lewis. This is the introduction to the volume. And it goes to the question of what Christian poetry even is. I mean, is it poetry about Christian themes? Is it poetry that exhibits Christian sensibilities? Is it poetry written by people who identify as Christian or who were raised as Christian, if they aren't still a kind of practicing Christians? And you cite Lewis saying that there's no such thing as Christian literature per se, or no such thing as Christian poetry per se. However, he says there are Christian approaches to literature. So I've got a couple questions about that distinction. I'll ask you this one first. First, do you like that distinction of his about not Christian literature, but Christian approaches to literature? Is that one you think that holds well?
Yes and no. I think it holds well in one sense that I think Lewis is right that there's no such thing as Christian poetry or Christian literature in the same way there's no such thing as Christian science or Christian architecture. I mean, you know, that there's good science and bad science. There's good math and bad math. There's good literature and bad literature. And I think, so there is a sense in which he's right about that, but I don't know that I would, the word approaches in particular is one that always kind of sticks. You know, I'm not sure that was the right word. And I don't ding him for that, but I think he's trying to get at that, you know, that there is different kinds of writing. And so you do certainly see what I would see today, some writers writing sort of neo-paganism, where it's a very flat, you know, verse that there are no symbols. It's very materialistic. And we're trying to write a very flat line and flat. Well, Christian poetry is one that does use symbols and representation because this is part of our tradition. And so I think he's trying to get at the fact, if we're going to talk about Christian poetry, that there are some characteristics of it that are there and that we can speak about and identify that vary, of course, from poet to poet, but that are still some sort of continuity.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I was reading your introduction, Micah, you know, one thing that really stood out to me was how, you know, you highlighted what I would think of as the essentially humble stance of the Christian artist, that the Christian artist is somebody who understands that there's only one person who creates ex nihilo, and it's not you. and that you understand fundamentally that you can't make something wholly original. You know, it's like trying to say a word that nobody's ever said before. You know, you can't do it. And that this is something that is going to underwrite the artist's relationship with what he's doing. And I agree. I think approach is kind of a lame word, because it really is something. I think it's something that's just a lot more deeper and integral and integrated than that. That's going to inform your relationship with tradition too.
Yeah.
That you're not waking up today and thinking, I'm going to be original, because you know you're not. You know you're always in conversation, and even a positive conversation with tradition, which was really interesting to me in reading some of the more experimental poets in this volume, like Shane McRae, for example.
Yeah, right.
Whose poetry on the page, you know, as you point out in the introduction, Micah, looks so postmodern in its construction and its interrogation of language. And yet I mean, McCrae says, I don't do anything in my poems that Philip Sidney wouldn't do. And I still have trouble sort of figuring out exactly what that means, but that's fascinating to me. And strikingly, I think, what Lewis is talking about.
Okay. Can I ask you a question, Sally, that picks up on something you said about the word approach? I mean, it's not a terrible term, but it's, as you point out, I agree with this, there's something far more integral and far more extensive than that about how we approach the world. I'm thinking here about Paul's famous admonition in Philippians, right? To think on whatever is true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, in short, whatever is virtuous. An important statement for many Christians. It's an article of faith in my own Christian tradition. Does that admonition of Paul's expand the parameters of what it might mean to approach literature as a Christian? If so, I'm wondering, what could one write a volume on learning to approach literature in a Christian way rather than write a volume of Christian poetry?
Yeah, I certainly think one could. And I think people do. I think, for example, I mean, this isn't poetry per se, but writing about literature, I think about the work of somebody like Karen Swallow Pryor, for example, and her critical introductions to great novels and her, what's the name of her? Shoot, I can't think what it is. her book on reading as a Christian, which is about how you approach great literature, whether it's explicitly Christian or not, as a Christian reader. And I can't think offhand of somebody who's necessarily doing that in poetry, but I certainly think it's possible and a conversation that is important.
Great. I wonder if we could get into the volume a little bit and actually talk about a couple of poems in here. It's a question for each of you. Can you think of a poem in the anthology here that captures something that you deem especially important about the anthology? I guess I'm wondering whether there's a poem that you think can speak not just for itself, but in some ways for what you're trying to capture with the anthology, or that puts its finger on something important about Christian poetry in America. And I wonder if we can sort of maybe read a couple of poems in here. Maybe you could each read one and have us talk about them for a minute. Is that possible?
Yeah, great. Yeah, I've got one, I think, that Perfect. I would like to talk about. It's Andrew Hudgens' Raven Days.
What page is that?
That's on page 91.
Great. Okay. There we are. Yep.
And I think why I like that poem in particular is for a couple of reasons. One, people have this conception of what Christian poetry is, and it's usually sentimental, you know, very uplifting. But there's an honesty you have, first of all, in the Bible, you know, and also in these poems. And this is a very honest poem about the suffering in the present world, the darkness of the present world. But it's also a poem that reminds us that God actually works through darkness and uses darkness, and that he's never absent, even in the darkest days. And so it doesn't offer any sort of Sunday school answer, but I like that balance between the two. So let me go ahead and read that for us, if that's okay. Or would you like
Please,
to read
no,
it?
That'd be great. Thank you.
This is, let me pull it up here, the volume. So Andrew Hudgens' Raven Days. These are what my father calls our raven days. The phrase is new to me. I'm not sure what it means. If it means we're hungry, it's right. If it means we live on carrion, it's right. It's also true that every time we raise a voice to sing, we make a caw and a screech, a raucous keening for the dead, of whom we have more than our share. But the raven's an ambiguous bird. He forebodes death, and yet he fed Elijah in the wilderness, and doing so fed all of us. He knows his way around a desert and a corpse, and these are useful skills. I love that turn. First of all, something I always look for in a great poem is that surprising little turn that he has, and it's that ambiguous bird.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I love that.
And, you know, remember, Elijah was despairing when God sent him the raven, despairing. Am I the only one? Is the only darkness here? And then God sends a raven to to feed him, and so yeah, it's a great poem. I really appreciate that.
And the end of the poem, he knows his way around a desert and a corpse, and these are useful skills. That really speaks, I think, more. I mean, that's certainly kind of an important Christian sentiment, but it's important just contemporary sentiment. I mean, that captures a lot of, I think, the zeitgeist in the current moment.
Right. Yeah.
Sally, where would you turn us?
Okay, on page 110 and 111, the poem Transfiguration by Marley Yeomans, which is a really different poem from the one that we've just heard, but it's one that just, I knew, this was one of the ones I sort of fought for inclusion, and I just love this. I guess what I can say about it is that it's an unrhymed sonnet. It's in a very sort of fluid, not strictly iambic, but very fluid pentameter with a structure like a Shakespearean sonnet, which was fascinating to me. And I think I'll read it first and then talk about why I think it's sort of like a archetypal poem for this project. Transfiguration. Here are three sleepers on a mountaintop, and here's a man awake beneath the sky. Coin-like, the moonshine rims the profiled head, and yet not moon, but glimmerings of fire that strengthen, shine like candlelight through snow, until the face, the hands, and raiment seethe. His shape of light is wholly beautiful and useless with the uselessness of art that's meant for nothing but the beautiful, that does nothing but transform utterly, and has no message to deliver us, but is the revelation of itself. Down in the gulf, a demon-raptured boy makes manifest the fallen world with howls. Mm. So I love that turn, that volta that you get in a Shakespearean sonnet, where you shift from the transfiguration to the world that's not yet illuminated by that light. Excuse me. I just think that's stunning. And I think what's really important about this is the way that it puts together this moment of Christ revealing himself in his complete isness, you know, that I am, you know, there he is. And the way that that's paired with the role of art, that, I mean, just as God is art in its lesser sense, also is not utilitarian. It's not there for the good that it can do us. It doesn't do anything but transform utterly. I mean, I just love that. It does nothing except transform everything. You know, that's just a great line. But that its value is that it is. And to me, that's at the heart of a Christian conception of poetry, and really at the heart of what I think this project is about. In one sense or another, every poem in this book, you know, is what, you know, is useless with the uselessness of art that's meant for nothing but the beautiful, even though sometimes it's not pretty, that does nothing but transform utterly.
I love that. There was a guest on the podcast back in season one, so this is a couple years ago, who's written a very good book. Her name is Christina Bieber-Lake, written a very good book called Beyond the Story, and it takes kind of a Christian theistic view of how to understand literature. And her point is that every act of storytelling, therefore novels, etc. So she's talking more narrative than poetry, but it's invested in an idea that is theological at heart, which is that there's a meaning and a purpose. There's a reason why we attend to characters and tell their stories. It's our way of saying we believe there's inherent value and meaning to the world, to our lives. We all want a meaningful life, a meaningful death. And she says, for that reason, there's no such thing as art for art's sake. Art does not exist for its own sake. It exists to sort of tap into this deeper impulse of ours for things that are meaningful and finally are directed toward God. What I love about this poem that you brought us to here, Sally, is that, you know, you kind of, God for God's sake in the beautiful and art for art's sake really fold into each other, right? So it obliterates the distinction between God's isness and art's isness. And then right at the end, those last two lines, down in the gulf, a demon-raptured boy makes manifest the fallen world with howls. So somewhere down below art and down below the place where God is transfigured, the human world goes on, and it's not nearly as defined by the rapturously beautiful as what we see on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, the sense in which, well, the word sacramental always occurs to me, in which, you know, reality is sacramental and that God is present in everything that is and in everything that's good and excellent and, you know, which includes the works of our hands that are good and excellent. There is something of God's excellence present in that. And that doesn't make the world less demon raptured than it is, yet that, you know, you just think about Hopkins and, you know, the Holy Spirit brooding over the world, you know.
Yeah, with bright wings.
Yes.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thinking about some more poets in here, I mean, if you were to, each of you kind of name maybe a half dozen poets in the anthology, perhaps some we haven't spoken about yet, and describe for us something you love about their work. It might give listeners a sense for who all is in the volume and what it is you think their poetry sort of brings to our understanding of poetry or of Christianity or things that are beautiful or things that are inspiring, you know, why they're here in this anthology in the first place.
Yeah, sure. I can start with a couple and then we can bounce back and forth maybe. And so I think one poet that I've really enjoyed reading and writing about is Diane Glancy. Mm-hmm. And she's early on in the volume, and she's a Native American poet, and her poems are just so whimsical with her exploration of a Native American diction and language. And she retells some of the traditional Christian stories, but with a sort of a native angle. And so she has such a great ear and she's so fun. I think that was something I really enjoyed about her. But you also have folks like Robert Shaw, maybe most readers won't know, but sort of his just his intellectual rigor and attention to detail. And his poems are very metaphysical in the Dunnian sense. You know, he takes a metaphor and just unpacks it and slowly unwinds it. And he just does an amazing job. You have to be attentive with him. But he's still wonderful. And so, having Diane Glancy on the one hand and Robert B. Shaw there next to her, I think of Timothy Murphy, who's passed on. And we have a couple of poets who have passed on, but we just couldn't bear the thought of not including them. And so, Timothy Murphy is just a wonderful poet. You know, he was a Yale graduate who went on to run a large, you know, huge hog farm in, was it North Dakota, South Dakota, one of the Dakotas, you know, and wrote these poems on the side and left the Catholic faith and came back to it later in life. And so his poems are just the devotional simplicity of poetry. I think sometimes we think of art as this exalted thing that has to be this great masterpiece, when really it's just a kind of communication between two people, you know, mm-hmm. and one that can be used in my everyday life. You know, it doesn't have to be something that I stand and have to, you know, sort of unravel. And so he's got poems of, you know, hunter's grace, a pray for a good hunt, and prayers of thankfulness, and a prayer to stay off the bottle, you know, and so forth and so forth. And so those are just great. And then, you know, Marilyn Nelson is also a wonderful poet. She's one of those poets who says, you know, my life has not been interesting at all, so I just write about other people, you know. So she's really this historical poet, go back and retell some of the, you know, African-American stories, and has a great couple of poems and a wonderful response to Philip Larkin's church going as well. And so those are a couple off the top. I don't want to take all, I'm sure there's others that, but those are just the diversity of voice and sensibility. And that was really, again, something that struck me. I was just really quite amazed. And it's just very rewarding, quite frankly, to see these poets who've done such great work over the years, faithful, quietly, you know, doing their work year in and year out, and to see their work next to each other is just quite stunning. So
Those are great poets.
Yeah, so for me, Jean Murray Walker is one standout. Just the way that, I mean, she has an amazing range, really. You know, her first poem is kind of a narrative poem about this English teacher, you know, just telling this human story that's like illuminated by a love for excellence and, you know, kind of the futility of what he's trying to do. And, you know, it's kind of marvelous. Little Blessing for My Floater, which is dedicated to George Herbert, and really did strike me, even though she's obviously not at that point channeling Herbert in any kind of formal way. You know, she's not doing things with rhyme and meter that Herbert does, but you know, it's just an intensely metaphysical poem in which this little physical inconvenience becomes this, you know, epiphany of grace. You know, I just thought that was marvelous. So, I mean, I love Jean Murray Walker. David Middleton is another favorite of mine, who I think is really, you know, there's kind of nobody writing like David Middleton. I think in the introduction, I channeled this back jacket blurb on one of his books in which Fred Chappell describes his poetry as stately, which has always seemed like the perfect word for somebody who's just writing this mostly unrhymed, you know, blank verse, but it's perfect, you know, from line to line. It's just completely metrical, completely measured, in this courtly way. And yet, you know, he's writing about these Louisiana landscapes and about being religiously betwixt and between as an Anglican who's from kind of Baptist Shreveport and lives in the Catholic South of Louisiana, and how he's both and neither and navigating those spaces, and also consciously understanding his vocation as a poet, really as a vocation. You know, there's the poem Ordinations, where he's comparing, you know, he's at the ordination of an Episcopal priest and, you know, is seeing this as, you know, an analog to his own calling as a poet. And I just love that. Gosh, Marianne Corbett is another one of our maybe lesser known poets who's just one of my favorite writers. She's a technically dazzling formal poet, although again, she has a huge range that, you know, we didn't really have room to showcase here, but the way that her description of fireworks at a state fair, you know, becomes like Isaiah saying, all flesh is grass. Yeah. You know, that's really the burden of that poem. And again, she's just really marvelous at these illuminating moments. A.M. Juster is another favorite of mine. The thing that really stands out to me about our selections from A.M. Juster is this poem, Three Visitors, which is about, you know, a family going to sleep at night with their baby in the house, and these coyotes come, you know, howling up, you know, up into their yard. And it's in this, you know, like the meter of Beowulf, the accentual alliterative Anglo-Saxon line, so that immediately, you know, you think of Grendel, you know, right. And yet they also become like, because there's three of them and it's winter and, you know, the language sort of points to their being almost like figures for the Magi too, even though he doesn't sentimentalize them to that extent. But, you know, the way that the things of the world are constantly pointing to this great story.
Yeah.
And that there's grace and not destruction.
Yeah.
So I just think that's a brilliant poem. So again, those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head that are just standouts.
There were so many to me that were new. I mean, there's some poems here are poets I was so grateful to see. I mean, the ones, you know, that you might expect, Christian Wiman, Mark Jarman, Scott Cairns, Tracy K. Smith, But there were a number that were new to me. I did not know about, and I was so grateful to learn about them. And I've started ordering some of their volumes of poetry, you know, as a function of reading some poems here. And there are some poems also I find in here that really capture for me what I love about Christian poetry in particular, and the reason why I like turning to it. Just one of them, you mentioned this poet, Jean Murray Smith, Jean Murray Walker, pardon me. And one of the poems, you know, I won't read it, it's lengthy, it's called Staying Power. And it's you know, subtitled In Appreciation of Maxim Gorky at the International Convention of Atheists, 1929, which is just really, really great. But what I love about this, though, is kind of where she takes them. I mean, it's a great setup for a poem, but the way that she ends up, just the last few lines, and I'll read the last few, she writes, "Oh, we have only so many words to think with. Say God's not fire, say anything, say God's a phone, maybe. You know you didn't order a phone, but there it is. It rings. You don't know who it could be. You don't want to talk, so you pull out the plug. It rings. You smash it with a hammer till it bleeds springs and coils and clobbery metal bits. It rings again. You pick it up, and a voice you love whispers hello." I find that really moving. The idea, you know, that out of our deep, you know, kind of doubts and out of the destruction that we make of our lives, even unwittingly, and out of the brokenness that we are and the tools that we use to try to contact God are, God nevertheless can reach us in some way or other, right? A voice comes through things that are broken, through those of us who consider ourselves broken. I find that to be a beautiful motif in many of these poems, and one that really, for me, was kind of a through line for many of them. Is there a through line for you across any of these poems?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I think there's something that I really appreciate about a number of these poems is this, balance between honesty and faithfulness, I think, that you come across in their work. And you see that here as well, you know, I mean, that and just the devotion to speak only what is true, not more than what is true, is something that I find. I can't think of, you know, particular lines that would be able to recite that highlight that, but in various ways, I find that is something that I find in these poems again and again that I come to, that I find that I'm not being lied to, but I'm also not being told that the world is hopeless. And there's some also very wonderful devotional poems of power that are there as well. And I think that just speaks for itself.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, one thing that something you said just made me think is that thread of the insufficiency of our own language for God, which is, for example, a real concern for Mark Jarman, and most of the poems of his that we included really do hammer that you know, we can say all kinds of things, like Questions for Ecclesiastes, which is a completely
devastating poem.
Yeah, there's no other word, right? Devastating. And just the complete insufficiency of human language to speak to this tragedy. And it's something that he takes up again in the Unholy Sonnets in a lighter way. You know, I can call God all these things, but I still haven't really said his name, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, that seems to be one thread that ties these together. And I guess the Jean Murray Walker poem that you were just citing made me think about that. I mean, even like the insufficiency of our own determination not to believe. You know, the insufficiency of our unbelief. I'll smash this phone, I'll, you know, burn things, you know, and everywhere I turn, you know, God is there, as the psalmist says.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. I love it. You know, you've made a great contribution to the field here, you know, I think both for American literature and especially, I think, American literature for people who are interested in thinking about you know, kind of place of Christianity in it, sort of poems that talk about not just God, but about kind of the search for meaning, for something like entirety or wholeness, and what it means to sort of seek that in artistic forms. I think that's really profound. What's next for both of you? Now, having done this, you know, now what?
Sally, you've got a novel that just came out, right? You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's just out.
Congratulations!
I'm putting together another collection of poems. Having had a big prose year last year, between working on this anthology and finishing the novel, I've been really determined to have a poetry year this year. So, putting myself through classical meters because I've never mastered classical meters. So that's been the thing lately.
Very good.
Yeah, I've got an essay and First Things coming out probably early next year on prosody, and I hope maybe to use that as a building block for another collection of essays on poetry. I've got a couple other essays, longer essays on poetry that have been sitting there, been published previously, but tried to collect them. So I need a few more, but I hope to be able to, in the next couple of years, have enough to pull them together.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I plan to assign this volume in classes I teach at BYU.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your excellent work. And thanks for taking the time today to talk to me on the podcast. It's really been a pleasure.
That's my pleasure as well. Yeah.
Blessings to you.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.